Well, we are going to put Ecclesiastes to bed tonight. We've been in this book for about 10 weeks, and what I want to attempt to do is, you know, do a bit of a summary tonight, as well as deal with the final few verses there. What we're going to do is we're going to wrap up Ecclesiastes tonight, then we're going to have 2 weeks in the Psalms, and then we're going to kick into our next teaching series, which will be Galatians. So have that in mind. The way we're going to do it tonight is we're going to be looking at that final section. So come back to Ecclesiastes if you're in 1 Corinthians. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, we're going to be working from verses 9 through to 14. And as we dive in and look at these final verses, what they force us to do is this. They force us to think back about everything we've been looking at throughout the whole of the book of Ecclesiastes, because it is effectively a bit of a summary. Tries to wrap up everything. So as we work our way through these verses, we're going to be thinking back at what we've been hearing. And that's going to, we're going to summarize what we've looked at, look at some of the big things tonight. Tune in there, verse 9 with me, and we'll see the kind of nature of the scripture we have been dwelling on over the last 10 weeks. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. What we've been looking at over the past few months is we've been hearing the voice of a wise teacher. And that voice of the wise teacher has been bringing a number of things to us. It says there he's been bringing proverbs to us. Yeah, he's been pondering and searching and thinking. He's worked hard to analyze life. Is this funny whistling noise that's happening? Can you hear it? Everyone listen now. And we'll get over and done with, and we'll ignore it for the rest of the time. It's bizarre. We thought someone was playing a trick on us earlier, but I think it's the wind. Just tune back in now. Come with me. The teacher has been working diligently to actually craft, and now you're going to be thinking about it the whole time, to be craft an account for us that we would pay attention to. He's been putting a whole bunch of proverbs down, but I think more than just putting down proverbial sayings for us, what he's been doing is, and if you've been with us, you'll know this, he's been conducting an experiment effectively. He's been testing a very particular kind of life. He calls it life under the sun. He's been testing that life, making observations about that life and coming to conclusions about that life. And as he tests the life, he's really asking this question: can meaning be found, like real deep meaning and significance in life, can it be found in all the usual things that people pursue with their days here on earth? He's testing that, and he's come to some serious observations and conclusions, and he wants to impart them to us. He wants to help us see his conclusions and reflections. And he's wise, and so we should listen. He's imparted that knowledge to us so that we would. And listen to the, look at how we're meant to be taking note of what he has gathered for us. Look at verse 11. The words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Given by one shepherd means, even though these are the teachings and the lessons from a wise man, ultimately these come to us from the one shepherd, our God. These are the words of wisdom that we need to hear from God himself. But we're told that as they come to us, and what they're meant to do for us is they're meant to be like two things. They're meant to be like goads and firmly embedded nails. So have they been? What does that mean? What does it mean for a saying or a lesson to be like a goad for you or a firmly embedded nail? It means simply this. A goad is apparently a prodding stick that a farmer would use to jab into the rear end of an animal that's heading in the wrong direction or not heading in any direction but just needs a damn good jab so it gets moving, right? That's what a goad is. It's usually got a sharp bit on the end. It's awful, isn't it, what farmers do? But anyway, they prod, jab the animal, the beast, to get it moving, or to at least get it moving in the right direction. So these words that have been coming to us, these lessons are meant to be lessons that prod us and get us moving, or get us moving in the right direction. They're meant to jab you out of your comfort zone. That's what they're meant to do. They're meant to give you a certain amount of discomfort so that you would be led to a better place. That's what these lessons are meant to do for us. So ultimately, If these wise sayings are meant to be like goads, they're meant to get you moving. There's the first thing. So have the things you've been reflecting on in this series got you moving? Have they caused you to change direction in your life, or at least course correct at some level? Have they? Secondly, they're meant to be like firmly embedded nails. Simply, a nail is something that goes in deep and it stays. These words, these lessons, are meant to be the kind of lessons that sink deep and stay put. This teaching is meant to be firmly established in our thinking and in our memory. It's meant to be the stuff we never forget. It's meant to be the kind of wisdom we hang on to. It's meant to be the stuff that stays with us. So has it been? Has the wisdom that we've been looking at over these last few weeks, the big lessons that the teacher has been trying to help us reflect on, have they been like goads and firmly embedded nails? Have they got you moving, and are they going to stay with you? Because that's the intent of this book. So if nothing that we've looked at over the last 10 weeks has actually got you moving, caused any action, or if it doesn't stay and remain so that it would cause future action, then you've missed the point of the wisdom you're meant to be getting. It's meant to have an impact. So what are the lessons? What are the words that we've been getting from the teacher over and over again? Because what I want to do tonight is I want to go over them again. And I'll tell you why I want to go over them again, or at least some of them again. If you've been with us through this series, and many of you have, and you've been working at it on your own in your daily reading and also in your growth groups, I trust you've noticed something about the book of Ecclesiastes. And I trust you've noticed this, that there's certain messages that the teacher keeps coming to us with. Yeah? There's certain pieces of wisdom that we just keep hearing over and over and over again. Have you picked up on that? We talk about death, and then we talk about work, and then we talk about pleasure, then we talk about wisdom, then we talk about death, and then we talk about pleasure, and then we talk about wisdom, then we talk about work, then we talk about work, and then death, and then pleasure, and then wisdom. And it just keeps going like this. Have you been catching that? It's cyclic. Now, some of you have been frustrated by it. You've been like, this is found it annoying. You know, we go, okay, tonight we're going to talk about death. And you're like, what? We just did that last week. And 2 weeks before that. That's what the book of Ecclesiastes is like. It's not progressive in its argument. And that's kind of what we're used to, really, because we do spend a fair bit of time, rightly so, in the New Testament letters, which have a progressive argument. Most of Paul's arguments are that. You get to wisdom literature like we're looking at here, and it's not progressive. It's cyclic, and there's repetition, and it drifts in and out of one area and then back around the back and comes back in again, and you're talking about the same thing. Because that's life. You keep dwelling on the same things over and over again. Why does the teacher here in Ecclesiastes keep going over the same ground again and again and again? Well, it's no mistake. He does it by design. We are hearing exactly what he intended for us to hear over and over again. And so, it would appear, my friends, that there are certain things that we apparently need to hear over and over again, week in, week out, because we forget them that quickly. I assume it's because there's certain things that we tend to easily forget over and over again. And there's things we need to be reminded of over and over again. And that's the case because of our hearts and because of the world we live in. They're both corrupted. Our hearts are so corrupted that we drift from God. We rebel from him, so we need to be brought back over and over again. And we live in a world that's corrupted and is wayward, so we are continually influenced to go in the wrong direction, and we need to be brought back over and over again. And so, friends, can I invite you, if you haven't really ever done this yet throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, can I invite you to come in humility and trust that even though we might look again at something tonight that you heard last week, you need to hear it again. Can I invite you to come with humility, whether you want to hear it or not, to trust that you actually need to hear it again? Because it's something you easily forget on a weekly basis, perhaps even on a daily basis. And when I say you, I mean me too. Us. We. Now, as I've tried to kind of do a bit of a summary of the kind of big things that come out of Ecclesiastes, I started with 8 things. And I thought, there's no way we'll get through that in one night. So I've whittled it down, or I've tried to join some together and boiled it down to three things, okay? So that's what we're going to try and do. We're going to look at three of the big things that keep coming up throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, and then we're going to get to this final section about fearing God and obeying his commands. So I've titled it this, Three Things We Easily Forget. Three things that you and I need to hear and remember over and over again. Friends, it's another opportunity for us to heed the lessons of the wise teacher. Please soften your hearts, come again, listen again. Here's the three things. Number one, the pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy you. Number two, much of your work is actually in vain. Number three, soon you will grow old and die, and no one will remember you. They're the three we're going to look at tonight. Super fun, yeah? But here's the thing. I'm human too. I don't want to dwell on these things. I'm with you on this one. But I trust that if this is what the Lord has for us, then deep reflection on these things, even these uncomfortable truths, is going to result in wonderful action and life and release and living the way God intends for us to live. And I know it's had that effect on many of you as you've reflected deeply and done the hard work. So let's look at the first one. Here's the first one. The pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy you. The teacher is pleading with us here. He says, believe me, I have pursued pleasure with more time and energy and finances than any of you will ever have at your disposal. I've pursued pleasure like you will never get the chance to do, and I've come to a conclusion you desperately need to hear. And he says, I've pursued pleasure, and effectively pursues pleasure in all the big areas that we tend to pursue pleasure. He looks at the three, I believe, three big life stages that we all go through, and looks at the different types of pursuits that we have in those life stages. And so come back to chapter 2 with me, and we'll look at it quite briefly. Here's where he tests pleasure. And you see in chapter 2, verse 3, he starts off testing what most of us would go after in the early stage of our lives. We want to have epic parties, or we at least want to be part of epic parties. And you see in verse 3 there, he says, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. So he just parties all out. He goes after fun. He goes after craziness. He goes after all the stuff you can go after. He throws massive parties day after day. And if you're here on the week, we looked at this one. The kind of parties that he would have thrown, him likely being King Solomon or one of the kings, he would have thrown the kind of parties that 20,000 people would be able to come to. And he did that night after night after night. They're like parties that you and I have never even been to, let alone would ever be able to throw ourselves. But he throws them and he parties hard. But it soon gets old. He gets tired of it. It gets boring and it gets a bit repetitive. So he moves on. That obviously doesn't do it for him. He moves on to what most of us apparently tend to do in the middle stage of our lives, is where we try to do something productive with ourselves, yeah? So he attempts epic projects, yeah? Purchases epic amounts of property and just develops it all. You can see this in verses 4 through to verse 6. He says, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. What he does is he goes and builds literally hundreds of houses, possibly even 1,000 houses, which is like a suburb or two. He plants gardens the size of forests, which makes kind of our house and garden shows just look really lame, what he does. He has farms that are dedicated to vineyards and fruit trees. He grows everything you could possibly grow. If you've dreamt of ever doing it with your life, if you've ever dreamt of ever building anything or doing anything, he did it 10 times bigger than you ever dreamt of, and he owned 60 million of them. And after he does all that, he arrives at the end point. He's built everything he'd ever think of building. And he's exhausted. And he kind of had a bit of fun along the way, but he's kind of left unsatisfied again. And so now he decides to enter the third stage of his life, apparently the stage we get to, that we all head toward, which I would call the end stage, the retirement stage, the stage in life where we think we deserve to be able to sit back and just enjoy the lifestyle that we've worked towards. He wants to now sit back and enjoy everything that he's worked at. And verses 7 through to 9, he describes the epic lifestyle that he pursues. And again, he pursues it with the kind of vigor that you and I will never be able to pursue it with. He actually ends up with an entire service industry at his beck and call. He has baristas and chefs and cleaners and masseuses. Masseuses, is that a word? He has trainers. He has everything for him, helping him. He has musicians and he has productions and he has everything at his beck and call. He has the delights of about 1,000 women, wives, concubines, unlimited, uninhibited sexual experience. You name it, he has it at his beck and call. And he comes to the conclusion after all of that, after the pursuit of pleasure like you and I will never be able to pursue it, and you've got to hear his conclusion. You've got to hear it. Look at verse 10. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor. In other words, I've got a bit of delight along the way. There's a bit of enjoyment in the process of it all, no doubt. But this was the reward for my toil. That's all there was. A little bit of delight along the way. He says, verse 11, yet when I surveyed all my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind, nothing was gained under the sun. He says, I arrived at the end point, the place where I thought I would find satisfaction and deep happiness and meaning in life, and realized I actually gained nothing. I'd been chasing the wind my whole life. And it's almost like he's trying to get us by the shoulders and just say, please believe me. Please believe me. When you go after things and you finally get them, you will find yourself saying this, oh, well, that didn't do it for me. And then you'll have a decision to make. And we've all had that. We all experience it regularly. You get the thing you've been working towards, and then you have that feeling of, you know, buyer's remorse or whatever it is, and you're like, I don't feel like I thought I would feel. It didn't do it for me. And that's the moment where you've got the choice to pursue truth or a lie. And the lie goes like this. And here's the lie we get continually told in our society. What you need to get real deep satisfaction and contentment and happiness out of life, what you need really is actually just more of what you've already got. That's the lie. You need more of what you've already got. You need a better version of it. You've got a car, but what you need is a newer one with more features that gets better fuel economy and safer for the kids. And you can walk up to it and do this with your leg and the back opens. You know, that's what you need, right? And when you get that car that just, you can go like that, you'll just be going, yes, you know? No, you'll be going like this and it won't work. Or if it does work, you'll be like, who cares? You know, the feeling won't come. That's what the teacher wants you to know. Or you're thinking, oh, I'm renting, but when I buy, then I'll really feel like I've arrived. Or you've bought and you think, I need to, if we can only reno this house or do this with the garden or move house closer to the beach or whatever, we come up with all kinds of things. Then we'll think, maybe then I'll get that feeling that I've been longing for. You know, God places eternity in the hearts of men that we'd continually search after pleasure, but we go after it in all the wrong places. We go after it in all the things. And a little funny one. We go after it in our food too. It's funny. We've got so much food available to us here in the West. We've got everything. But we keep inventing new versions or combinations of what we already got to try to make us happier. Have you seen what we've been doing lately? You've heard of the turducken, haven't you? You know, Christmas is not enough to just have turkey. You want to have turkey and chicken and duck. So you stick the duck up the chicken and the chicken up the turkey, and it's called turducken. And then we can eat turkey and duck and chicken all together, and then maybe we'll get the feeling, you know? It's not enough to have donuts these days. You've got to have cronuts. Have you heard of them? A croissant donut. They're selling them around the corner. Haven't you had a cronut? You haven't lived. Yeah? Or have you had a duffin? Yeah? A donut muffin. They sell them down at the Emporium. You haven't lived. And can you see our pursuit? How we just continually pursue more of what we've already got, thinking that's going to make a difference, and it never does. And we've got a guy who's gone before us, hunting pleasure like we could never do, and he's just trying to get us there. Listen, you won't ever arrive by searching with things in this world. The truth is, the pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy you. Have you let that piece of wisdom be a goad and a nail? Like, has it sunk in? Has it caused there to be any change, any action, any course correction? Because I think it's easy for, we laugh, we hear it, we let it wash over us and we just keep doing the same thing with our lives. What is with that? No, no, no. This is meant to come to us so we change and you live differently. And you stop pursuing life in things under the sun. Now listen up. The pursuit of pleasure is not the problem. We pursue pleasure because we're wired for pleasure. We will always pursue pleasure. The problem is where we pursue it and how we pursue it. That we keep pursuing it in life under the sun, things. And the truth is, friends, pleasure will never be found in life under the sun. True pleasure and deep satisfaction can only be found in the one who is beyond the sun, who made the sun. You know, Jesus says, no, I am the place where you find it. You know, when he's speaking to the woman at the well, he says, come and I'll give you living water and you'll never thirst again. Pleasure, satisfaction, deep contentment, that thing you long for, and you've been looking for it in everything, in relationships, the thing you long for is in your Creator, in relationship with Him. Friends, real satisfaction is found in your Maker, not in His stuff. Real, deep contentment is life is found in relationship with Jesus, not in the stuff He can bring you in this life. That's where it's found. There's the first one. The pursuit of pleasure in life under the sun will never satisfy. Here's the second one. And here's one, by the way, that I know many people found really hard to consider and got angry with me about. So let's do this one again. So you got more chance to get angry. In a good way, though. It's good. I love it. It's great. The second one is this. Much of your work is actually in vain. The teacher here says, your work, your labor, well, he says, he's reflecting on his own, he says, my work, my labor, my toil, meaningless, vanity. It's in vain. Now catch this. When the teacher says all of your work is meaningless, he's not saying it has zero meaning. What he's saying is this. He says that in the end, it amounts to nothing permanent. That's what he means by meaningless when he's considering work. In the end, your gain from your work is just temporary. And he says, well, that's just meaningless. Now have a look at chapter 1, if you're still there in chapter 2. Have a look at what he says. Chapter 1, he says, verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. Look at verse 3. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? And you come over to chapter 2, verses 17. So I hated life, because of the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it's meaningless, chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to one who comes after me. He's looking at his work and he's looking what he gains for his work, but what's frustrating him more than anything is that his gain is just temporary. It's just momentary. It doesn't last. And he goes, well, that's meaningless. If I've got to work my whole life and then leave it behind to someone else, he's just saying, what's with that? That's a bit useless, isn't it? A little bit of enjoyment along the way, but then I leave it all behind? Is that it? Is that all we get in life? The teacher says, so much of our work and toil and labor is just temporary. It doesn't last on into the future. And so he says, that's in vain. Now, when we looked at this 2 weeks ago, we then went and looked at the good news we find in the New Testament, which is that there is a kind of work, there is a kind of labor that's actually not in vain. Yeah? So we went to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 58, and we spent some time trying to dig into what that kind of work is. And when Paul says that there's a kind of work that's not in vain, what he's meaning is there's a kind of work that results in something that is permanent. There is a kind of work that results in something that will last on into the future, long after you're dead and gone. And you can give yourself to that kind of work and labor today. I say we do that. I say we maximize our ability to do that kind of work. And here's where it gets controversial. Paul calls that work, he uses a phrase called the work of the Lord or the labor of the Lord. And he says, always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, meaning it's possible to not always give yourself fully to this particular kind of work. But he says, no, do everything you can to always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord. And we did a bit of a Bible study when we considered that phrase, and here's where it does get tricky, because Paul's making a distinction between different kinds of work here. He calls one kind of work the work of the Lord, and then he calls other kinds of work, he calls it work for living. Now, there is overlap, we'll talk about that in a minute, but Paul is very clear to make a distinction. And when you trace through the Bible about the way that phrase work of the Lord is used, you come up hearing to see that phrase is used to mean this. The work of the Lord is, strictly speaking, disciple making. And here's the big end, and please hear the end, because many of you, I don't think, heard the end. Disciple making and any efforts that contribute toward that cause. So any efforts or work that is done that contributes towards the cause of strengthening the church and building the church, whose primary mission is the making of disciples, is considered work of the Lord. That's the way Paul describes it. And that kind of work is not in vain. And it's not in vain because God says his word never returns to him empty, but always accomplishes that for which it was sent, meaning salvation or judgment. It's never in vain when you're swept up into that kind of work. It's not in vain because what it accomplishes will last beyond this life. What it accomplishes will ring on for all eternity. Paul makes a distinction between the kind of work he does. He says, some of the work I do is strictly speaking the work of the Lord. And then he says, other work that I do, and he speaks about his tent making, he says, this is work for a living. He makes that distinction in chapter 9. Happy to talk some more about it, or fire a question at me in a minute if you want. He makes that distinction, but then no doubt there's this, please hear me. He makes the distinction, and you've got to get the distinction first before you get this next point. He makes the distinction, then he says, and no doubt there is some overlap. And there certainly are areas of life where those two things, though they're distinct, overlap. So that lots of your work that you're caught up in can actually end up being work of the Lord, because it leads to people becoming disciples of Christ. And that's your intent in it. Colossians 3 says, anything we do can be done under the Lord. And it can. All work is meant to be for the Lord. But Paul says, there is something called the work of the Lord. And he says, I want you to always give yourselves fully to that. What's at stake in this is a lot, I believe. So that's why I wanted to go there again. What's at stake in, if you miss the distinction here, you miss Paul's instruction. You miss his command to always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord. And I think the best way for us to try to wrestle with what that might mean for each of us, and it's a different thing for each of us, it's going to mean this. I think this is the most helpful way to unpack it. Maximize your work of the Lord. Minimize other forms of work. Do everything you can to give as much of your time and energy towards things that are, more strictly speaking, the work of the Lord. Because they are the ones that result in permanent things, things that ring on for all eternity. So give yourself to that. Now, this piece of teaching, this lesson has been all the way through the book of Ecclesiastes. Have you let this one be a goad and a nail? I know some of you have. I know some of you have actually made decisions about what you're doing with your life at the moment based on this, because you want to maximize your energies towards what is, strictly speaking, the work of the Lord, and minimize other things. I know some of you have been convicted enough to do that. Others of you haven't let it sink in yet, or you haven't wrestled enough with what I'm talking about here. Or you disagree with me. Or you're so offended you don't want to engage in what's being said here. Don't do that. Engage in what Paul's talking about. And you might want to ask a question in a little bit. Let's get to the third one, so we can wrap up and leave some time. The third one is this. Soon you will grow old and die, and you will not be remembered. That's just wonderful, isn't it? Come back to chapter 12. We looked at this last week. And if you missed last week, don't worry, we'll do it now. We get told last week, you know, verse 1 there, that what's coming for us all is a certain group of days that he calls the days of trouble. The days of trouble are coming for us all. Brace yourself. When those days of trouble come, your body will age and begin to deteriorate. And he gives us a list of metaphors right through from verse 2 through to 5. And the metaphors basically represent different members of our body. And basically he wants us to spend time reflecting on what's going to happen to each of the different members of our body. It's going to impact your mind. Aging will impact your plumbing, your hands, your arms, your legs, your back, your hair, your eyes, your ears, your teeth, your sleep patterns, your sexual desire, and then you'll die. That's kind of the encouragement that he gives us there. And he wants us to spend time coming face to face with the reality that we're all going to age and then die. And he wants us to feel the very real frustration of that and the pain of that and how undignifying it is for most. Friends, they will be the days when, as he says in verse 1, where you and I will both say, I find no pleasure in them. You'd prefer not to be alive. He wants us to kind of see and feel the devastation of sin effectively here, because the reason why we age and die is sin. This was not God's intent for us. And so as we feel the devastation of it, we're to reflect on sin, which is our rejection of our Creator, and actually feel the horror of that as we feel the horror in our own bodies. It wasn't meant to be this way. It wasn't meant to be this way. And in as we dwell on those things, I do believe the teacher wants us to dwell on for long enough that we would find ourselves turning and seeing the reality of the days we do have right now before us, and to make decision to make the most of life while you have it. He calls the life you have now your days of youth. They're the days that come before the days of trouble. So any day where you've still got life in your body, life in your bones, he would say, that's you still in your days of your youth. Make the most of the days of your youth. And the way he tells us to do that is very clear. You remember your Creator. You remember him, not just every now and then, you remember him being, you live constantly aware of him. You live constantly chasing him. Yeah. But the final sting that we kind of get, and actually you get it back in chapter 1, don't turn back there unless you want to. The final sting we get after that is we're all going to age, then we're going to die. And then, this is just wonderful stuff, he says, after you're gone, no one will remember you. No, it's just terrible to hear. Chapter 1, he says, generations come and go. No one, in verse 11, no one remembers the former generation. And those who are not born yet, those who are still yet to come, they're not going to remember us. It's just not nice to hear. Now, some of you don't really get that stressed by that one. You find yourself just going, oh, that's okay. I don't really want to be here anyway. I don't care if no one remembers me. Yeah, just to be completely honest, some of you I know, that's how you think. Others of you, You think differently. You're thinking, no. I like the concept that I'm significant. I want to hear that I get to leave my mark on this place. I want to hear that I get to leave it a better place than I found it. I want to hear that I'm going to be remembered for the life that I live. Now, you will be, for sure. Your friends and family will remember you for a bit. They will for a bit. But then they'll die. So they won't be able to keep remembering you. So we will, to a certain extent, be remembered, but not for very long. Let me illustrate my point. How many of you remember a fellow named Willoughby Bean? Remember Willoughby Bean? Ever heard of a guy named Willoughby Bean? You have? Is that right? One. That's good, Sal. Well done. Well, let me tell you about Willoughby Bean. I had to go hunting through the history books to find out about Willoughby Bean. He was like one of the most famous guys that lived around here. He was really well known on the Central Coast. He was one of the first guys to move here. He actually owned most of the Central Coast. He owned all the property between Wombe Lagoon and Terrible Lagoon. Terrible Lagoon it is. Terrible. West. All the way out to here towards Erinnerin and beyond, like a big triangle. Most of you live on land that used to be his. Willoughby Bean. He was so well known, so famous. You don't even know who he is. What's with that? That's terrible. It was back in the 1820s, but he owned this place. What about a fellow named, I've got to look down because I don't know. What about a fellow named Henry Donison? He came in after Willoughby died and bought all of Willoughby's property and lived in his house and developed the timber industry around the Central Coast and did so much to contribute to this being a place where people could exist and live. I can't believe you don't know who he is. You don't know who Henry is, do you? And I didn't either. What about Renamedes? Know who he is? The truth is, we're talking here about really significant, famous, important, honoured figures in the community who did more than you and I will ever do for a community like ours. But 150 years later, we haven't got a clue who they are. It's just sobering to know. No doubt they were remembered for a generation maybe, but a couple of generations come and the memory of you disappears. It's important for us to face the facts. Soon you're going to grow old and die and no one's going to remember you. Now, what do you do with that? What do you do with that piece of wisdom? It's like, thank you very much. I'd rather not hear it. How do you let that be a goad and a nail? Has that lesson kind of sunk deep? Has it caused there to be any change for you in your life? Here's how it stirs me. I find myself thinking, well, that sounds like it's true, actually. I don't want to hear it, but yep, no one's going to know who Tim Baldwin was. No one's going to care. No one's going to remember my name. My legacy, chances are, will not be my name. But my legacy can be his name, the name of Jesus. It may be that no one remembers me, but I'll tell you what, it is possible for me to live in such a way that helps the next generation to remember Jesus. And that sounds far better anyway. So I'm going to give myself and live a life that's going to help that happen. Because that matters more than anything. Friends, can I encourage you to join me in that reflection? Let's live in such a way today that we leave behind an entire generation of people who know Jesus and love his word. And let's leave them with resource that equips the ministry to keep happening so more on the Central Coast hear about Jesus and beyond. Let's give ourselves to that, that Jesus is remembered, that the gospel keeps going out. How do we live that kind of life? What does that kind of life look like? Well, I reckon the answer to that question is in these final verses of chapter 12. So let's get there. It's where I've been heading this whole time. Here's the kind of life we're encouraged to live. The conclusion of the matter comes for us in verse 13 there, chapter 12. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God. Keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of mankind. And when it says there, this is the whole duty of mankind, the word duty is not actually there. It's more literally, this is the whole of mankind. Meaning this is the whole of your life. This is it. This is why you exist. This is your purpose. You exist to simply fear God, obey his commands. That's the life we're called to live. Now, some of you are hearing that and it sits really well with you. You're like, yes, amen. I get that. That is life, to fear my Creator and obey him. Others of you are feeling uncomfortable at the concept. And let me suggest that you're uncomfortable possibly with the concept of fear. And I would say it's because we live in a society which I would say has a really kind of one-dimensional understanding of the concept of fear. Whereas the Bible has what I want to suggest is a three-dimensional understanding of the concept of fear. The one-dimensional concept, the one-dimensional understanding of fear usually goes like this. Well, fear is bad. Fear is a negative emotion. Fear is simply being terrified or frightened and scared so that I want to run away from somebody or run away from something. Fear is equivalent to craven terror and I just want to bolt the other way. And those of you who might simply have that understanding of fear, which I want to suggest is a one-dimensional understanding of fear, you'd go to the Bible and you'd find verses that say, fear not. You know, in other words, run from that kind of fear. Or 1 John 4 does say, perfect love drives out all fear. Yeah? So some Christians will say, well, that's it. I'm never to fear. I'm never to fear God. I'm never to fear anything. Well, no, perfect love drives out all fear. It drives out all of particular kind of fear. And I want to suggest that craven terror of God fear. Perfect love should drive that out. But when you come to the Bible, I reckon I want to encourage you to step towards a more complex and biblical understanding of fear. A three-dimensional picture of fear that you might describe like this. I want to say it's healthy fear. Or a right-placed fear. That instead of causing you to run away from God, it actually causes you to want to draw near to Him in reverence and rejoicing. Instead of causing you to actually be bound up, which is what we think fear does, instead of just binding you up, a healthy fear is the kind of thing that's going to release you to live the way you were designed to live. Joyful obedience, holy, godly living. The kind of fear that we're called to here, to fear our God, is a kind of fear that leads to joy. A fear that can exist with joy and rejoicing in the same moment. And you see this in the Psalms all the time. A lot of the Psalms have these couplets where they join fear together with the kind of thing that we think is the opposite of fear. Let me just read a few of them to you. Psalm 2 says this, serve the Lord, that sounds good, with fear. It says, celebrate His rule or rejoice in His rule with trembling. You know, the Bible gets these two things we think are opposite and puts them together and says, no. Real fear, healthy fear, is actually going to cause you to celebrate and rejoice in the Lord. Psalm 22 says, those who fear the Lord, praise the Lord. If you actually fear Him, you will praise Him. You'll be overjoyed with Him. Psalm 147 says, those who fear the Lord put their hope in His unfailing love. That's what fear causes you to do. Put your hope in His love. So embrace a bigger picture of fear, I want to encourage you. Embrace a biblical picture of fear. And if you find yourself thinking, yeah, joy is kind of lacking in my life. I'm not really rejoicing in my God. I'm not really praising Him that much. And I don't really want to serve Him at all. I want to suggest the problem is fear. You don't fear God. You don't fear Him like you should. You don't tremble before Him in a healthy way that would cause you to overflow in rejoicing and trembling. Fear leads to joy. It's a kind of fear that leads to joyful obedience, which is why we're called here to fear God and keep His commandments. This fear is a fear that's based on an understanding that He is the one that made me, this is His world that I live in, and one day I will stand before Him. You'll notice the final verse of Ecclesiastes, us, we're told to fear God and obey His commands. The reason is because for God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it's good or evil. And if that's the case, if I am going to stand before this God, then that's going to cause me to fear Him in a way today that means I will obey Him and I will seek to do what pleases Him and I will be most concerned about what He thinks of my life. And while I acknowledge I will always, in a sense, fear people, you will always, in a sense, be concerned about what people think of you and what they might do to you. Our highest calling is to choose to fear God more. People can harm you. People, Jesus would say, can destroy your body, but there are bigger things. Jesus says, fear the one who can not only destroy the body, but then throw your soul into hell for an eternity. Fear that one. Hebrews says, our God is a consuming fire. Friends, healthy fear leads to joyful obedience. If you've never made that connection, you need to press into fear. You need to understand what the Bible means by fear and go after that life. And I'll say that for this reason. I'll finish on this. Proverbs, another wisdom literature book, starts by saying this. In chapter 1, it says, fear is the beginning of all wisdom. You get to Ecclesiastes and we hear, fear is the end of all wisdom. Fear is the beginning and the end of all wisdom. Fearing your Creator is the beginning and the end of your life. It is the whole duty of your life, the whole purpose and point of your existence. It's what's going to bring you meaning and satisfaction and contentment more than anything else, is learning to live and fear your Creator in a healthy way that drives joyful, reverent obedience and life in Him. There you go. There's a big summary spray and a dig into those final verses at the end. I want to just pause now for a minute and give you a chance to reflect. So please feel free to, you might want to make a comment, you might want to share something you've found helpful through this whole series. And you're allowed to disagree with the bloke up front. That's okay, because we all sit together under this and work hard to understand it together. So bless you guys.